Welcome back to another episode of the Development by David podcast with me, your host, David McIntosh. This week I'm joined by the amazing, the Scottish, Rory Fairbairns. He's the co-founder of One Year No Beer, an online subscription-based platform for promoting an alcohol-free lifestyle with over 100,000 global members. You might have seen his episode on the Rich Roll podcast or seen his conversation with Richard Branson. However, this episode explores the gradual transformation of society's relationship with alcohol. You might have seen more friends have become more sober or have been drinking less. And this episode highlights the need for heightened awareness like that of its negative impacts on the mind and the body. We delve deep into stress, trauma, ADHD, emotional sobriety, and the pivotal role of and the transformative journey toward an alcohol-free or alcohol-conscious lifestyle. And these insights stem not just from textbooks, but from Rory's turbulent and emotional childhood that began in the Isle of Mull and saw him attempt suicide at the age of 14. But who would know, a letter to Richard Branson and later a conversation with him in Barbados would change and save his life. But this episode dives deep into the effects of alcohol and what it does to your mind and your body. We expose the risks of casual drinking, including the Thursday night pints after work, and we show that alcohol by no means results in stress management. We also talk about the sober curious lifestyle that I'm kind of on, which acts as a far better way to reap the rewards of a sober lifestyle without the need for total abstinence. In fact, 94% of people surveyed want to have a better relationship with alcohol but do not want to quit. So, how do we have a more conscious booze culture? And what are some of the low-hanging fruits to reap the time-rich life that an alcohol-free life gives you? How can we have a better relationship with your family, your mind, and your body through a conscious approach to alcohol? Join Rory and I, who'll give you the tools you need. And before we get into this episode, I want to let you know that I launched a Patreon. Yes, Patreon is the online membership program whereby you can get early access to this episode and every other episode that comes out before anyone else does. For the price of a coffee, you can support this podcast. I don't have a trust fund, I don't have any corporate backers, and I definitely don't have a sugar mama. But if you are one, please reach out. Jokes aside, you can even access my next episode with Jimmy Carr before anyone else. You can see it, and it's all cinematic 4K glory. If you join my Patreon for less than £4 a month, head along to patreon.com/developmentbydavid. All the links will be in the bio. Become an OG at patreon.com. Rory Fairbairns, welcome to the Development by David podcast. How are you?
Not many people say that name correct the first time, David.
Mate, it's You're nice to hear Scottish. Another Scottish accent on the podcast. It's been a while.
All of the different versions I get is... You know, because I'm talking to you, my accent is going to go way more Scottish. Everyone's going to listen to this podcast and be like, you don't sound like that normally. But that's what happens. If I go back to Mull, you can be sure that the accent starts to come back pretty quick.
Mate, my only objective, beside dispelling alcohol, is to revert you to using like Mull slang on the podcast. That's the only thing I want for this podcast.
Yeah, great. I'll try and think of something.
Rory, when people ask you, what do you do? How do you bring that to life?
I normally just say I'm helping the world drink a little bit less alcohol. And that usually starts off a conversation. Sometimes when we go out, my wife will say, please don't. Because she knows that the moment I say it, it becomes the topic of conversation. And it becomes a topic of conversation for the whole evening. I mean, we can go to a wedding and through the night, because this thing has been raised, people will either justify themselves or deny or come back a little bit more. You know, see, I'm not actually drinking that much. You know, I don't actually, I did tell you. So if you want to entirely dominate the conversation, and I've never found it just to be, you know, one of those moments where they might do like the networking piece. Could everybody just stand up and say, you know, blah, 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 blah. I've never found that it's like, oh, I'm an accountant. And everyone goes, great, thanks. Sit down and go to the next person. You know, it's like, help the world drink a little bit less alcohol. It's like, oh, can we stop there and start digging into that one? And then I think the next part is usually trying to justify it. And that could be my own ego. that immediately gets stunted. Because I think straight away people, the first thing is, well, is this, what is this? You know, are you a person who is counseling people one-on-one? So then there usually follows by a little definition of either how big the organization is or where, how many countries we operate in, you know, the kind of impact that we've had, and maybe a little bit of a description of the tools that we use, you know, that we have apps and we have various different digital programs, coaching certification, we run events and retreats and all of those kind of things. And they're like, wow. And you know how some people like to drop in, like, oh, we're Airbnb for taxis. But then my answer to that is, it's like Weight Watchers for alcohol. And that usually a bit of a definition.
The first answer you gave me was helping the world drink a little less. Why does the world need that, really?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, I think we're starting to wake up to the truth about alcohol. As we are many things, but I mean, if you look at social media these days, everything is killing you. I just don't know where to turn. I mean, we basically have to just drink water and stay at home. But the truth about alcohol is that it's, you know, 100% toxic. It's a neurotoxin. It's really damaging to our brains, to our bodies. You know, it causes inflammation. There's a huge amount of downstream impact from regularly consuming alcohol, and I think now as more and more funds that are not alcohol industry funds, that are anything else but alcohol industry funds, are coming into research and giving us unbiased and truthful research, which that's another whole conversation to have, about the misinformation in the alcohol industry, just like the tobacco industry and everything else out there that's, you know, anyway. So the truth is that this thing is really harmful to us. Not only that, but when you look at society and the societal impact, it's huge. So if we put it into numbers term, the last estimate was $52 billion a year it costs the UK economy. And that's a mixture of different things. So when you look at the health issues that it looks at, and again, I would say that's underestimated because now we're starting to put more two and two together. So we're now saying, you know, it used to be one or two cancers, right, that alcohol causes breast cancer. That's an absolute fact, okay? Alcohol causes breast cancer. But now it's being attributed to many more cancers. And again, as a byproduct, or in reality, which is what it does, it creates the perfect environment for cancers to foster. So that environment of inflammation, that environment of a toxin inside your body, all of those things, depleting your immune system, robbing your immune system of the tools it needs, the harm it does to the gut and your ability for the gut to repair, all of that kind of stuff. So it is creating a perfect breeding ground for that. We now know that it's directly linked to things like dementia and Alzheimer's, but also, so we talked about the cost there. That's not just societal cost. So societal cost is, you know, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but let's call it 40% of suicides are under the influence of alcohol. Violent crime, vast majority is committed under the influence of alcohol. Domestic violence, vast majority is under alcohol and drugs. Car accidents, let's keep going, right? So you get the point here that a huge amount of cost, societal cost. And then look at loss of earnings. So, you know, hangovers, lack of productivity, sick days, all of those things. That's another huge downstream impact of alcohol. And I think that is one very large element that's driving this change. But the other part of the change is, I think, just an awakening, the awakening of ourselves to say, well, hang on a minute. You know, I've been told my whole life, certainly on West Coast of Scotland, right? If West Coast of Scotland was its own country, it'd be one of the highest drinking countries in the world. So yeah, if you cut off Highlands and Islands and a couple of, you know, Garland Butte and things like that, very, very, very heavy drinking. And so I've been probably like you, conditioned to believe that alcohol is pertinent to everything, you know, any moment, celebrate, commiserate, congratulate, death, happiness, wedding, you name it. Oh, it's Friday. Oh, it's Tuesday, whatever it is.
People will celebrate passing their driving test with a beer.
Yeah, I passed my driving test drunk. I was at a party, and I'd been at the party.
That was a joke.
All night. And 6 o'clock in the morning, I had a vodka and tonic in my hand, and I went, oh, fuck, I have my driving test at 9 o'clock. And everyone was like, what? And I literally put it down. I mean, I tried to cram some thoughts half drunk and then got into the car, and I passed. So that was very lucky, very fortunate. Yeah. So, but again, there's more of an awakening, and the awakening is coming from this. Hey, I want to be healthy. I want to look after myself. I want to be a good dad. I want to be a good wife. I want to have more productivity. I want to lose weight. I want to be more successful. I want to have longevity. I'd really like to be running around the garden with my grandkids. And I'm actually thinking about that. You know, I'm thinking a bit more about having a good, healthy life. And this is showing up in the statistics with youth or young millennials, Gen Zs, and all the other, I don't know, because I can't remember. We're on to like, what's the name? We're back to A or something now. My daughter's A. Or, is it A?
I think so.
Gen A? I think so, yeah. So my daughter's Gen A, just the first one. So they're choosing not to drink, but in a much larger scale, a much larger percentage, which is really exciting. So, but that's coming from a different space, the space of desire, of wanting to be something. And this is what we tried to create. We tried to create something that could be aspirational, you know, that this is a sense of achievement, that this is a positive thing to do in your life. I think if you were to go into many cultures, certainly West Coast of Scotland, again, in many, and less so now, and say, you know, I'm thinking about drinking less alcohol, and they'd be like, what? What's wrong with you? I didn't realize you have a problem. Come on, you know, we all want to drink more here, if we could, right? And so you had to have a problem or a reason, or you had to have something. You're one of those people that's an alcoholic, as an example. But now I think that's changing quite significantly. I think people are doing it because they want the benefits, they want the advantages, and they're realizing the positive sides of taking a break from alcohol.
I've heard you describe consuming alcohol as a keystone habit, as other habits interlink to that grander habit. But I also see alcoholism being a keystone failure to society. Like you said, you brought to life the health outcomes and the health risks, but also the increased crime rates. And I can imagine the teenage pregnancy rates are through the roof because of alcohol. It seems like a keystone failing for our society. You've tasked yourself with helping the world drink a little less. This seems like a mammoth feat for one guy to embark on. So my question to you on that, Ruri, is why you? How did you know you were the guy for the job?
Well, I think there's a lot of people out there doing good work. You know, I don't feel like I have any competitors. I just think that there's people here trying to help people. I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think the more sober coaches there are, the more people who are trying to help people drink less alcohol in the world, I think is a fantastic thing. When I look at what we've built here, you know, over 100,000 people in 138 countries have been through our programs. But we spent millions over the last few years on advertising. We've had millions of people listen to our podcast and millions of people look at our free content. And I've had, you know, thousands and thousands of messages from people who said, you know, I didn't sign up to your program, but you changed my life. And the wider impact of that, right? Because somebody says, oh, I stopped drinking because of you. Thanks so much after watching this podcast. I mean, maybe it'll happen on this show, David, that you'll get a message from somebody saying, I listened to that message and that's it. I've decided to put it down. And you won't just change that person's life. You'll change the life of their kids. You'll change the life of their family. You'll change the life of some people around them. Their friends might even decide to change, which is why it's such a, it's an amazing thing that has such an incredible impact on people. I think that, you know, when you say why, well, first of all, it's not me. There's a lot of people. I mean, there are probably close to 60 people full-time operating in my organization who help run this thing on a daily basis. I've always said to people, I'm 5% genius, 95% absolutely fucking useless. So if I don't have a team of people around me just to get out of bed and make it to work on time, then I fail. So it's important to have a good team. Why the mission? You know, this is a longer story I'm sure we'll get into, but when I'd always been looking for something to have an impact in the world, and I guess I had always felt different. And I think this is very common with ADHD. I'm ADHD, excuse me. And there's this driven feeling of, certainly when people didn't understand it, you know, back in the 1980s on the Isle of Mull, nobody knew what ADHD was. They just knew they didn't like it. And so it was disruptive. It was lack of focus. It was misbehavior. It was, you know, and so it was, you know, he's troublesome and he's not, you know, so that then created this sort of belief that I was different. And on the flip side, I had my parents who were very loving and they wanted to try and, I mean, they were pulling their hair out at times because I was very destructive, but they were very supportive and they were like, you know, you're special, you're gifted. So it kind of created these two different parts, a part of me which felt like I was special and different and gifted, and another part feeling of not belonging. And this is extremely common with ADHDers, and often why they go on and set up businesses, because they just feel like, well, hang on a minute, I'm meant for something different. I'm meant for something greater. And I don't really fit into the typical cog that is, you know, building a business, working in an enterprise. So from a young age, I'd already had that feeling of that sense that I was going to be different. Yeah, I mean, when I was 13, 14, again, really, really struggling with my identity, I tried to take my own life. And 13 was the first one, 14 was the second one. First time I had my stomach pumped, which is horrible, pretty miserable. Second time I tried to hang myself. And coming from that, you know, my parents, my dad, he was obviously very shocked. But he worked in Childline, and he had dealt with all sorts of things like this before. A lovely man who cared immensely and wanted to help people. You know, he would speak to kids in Glasgow and who were very, very troubled. And, you know, he'd learnt over the years of working in Childline that if you can give them hope, if you can give them some kind of hope, then they usually pull through. Obviously, there's other factors. So he wanted me to have hope, and he encouraged me to write a letter to somebody who inspired me. And my dad was called Richard, and he runs a recording studio, and he's a bit of an entrepreneur and, you know, crazy hair and all of this kind of stuff. And I knew another Richard out there in the world who had a recording studio, Richard Branson. So I wrote him a letter. And in that letter, I said, I'm going to change the world one day, and I'm looking forward to having lunch with you. A few other things were said in there, of course, but that was about the crux of it. And I think that probably highlights two things. One, how odd that was from a boy from the Isle of Mull. So I was definitely different from an early age. And two, I'd started to build this kind of belief. And when I got into my teens and 20s, I started my first business when I was 15, five companies by the time I was 25. All the way through that, I was like, I know this is going to happen. I know I'm going to be there. It might be delusions of ego and grandeur. I don't know. But I was like, I don't feel like Richard Branson is any different from me. I believe that I'm going to be on that stage. So, but I didn't have any success. I was building these businesses and they were all failure. And meanwhile, building those businesses, you know, I was drinking and partying. I met drugs. I was decompressing all the time with alcohol and drugs, and partying very hard. Shall I keep going?
No, I love it. I love it. I want to ask you about your moment of near fame, which was applying for The Apprentice and being flown down to London to the very final stages. Tell me about that, Ruri.
Well, I built up these companies, and I mean, the largest of which, I was in Edinburgh, employed 10 people full time. And once I had been completely shafted by quite a large blue chip company, and we were forced to wind up the business, shut it down. I went back up to Mull to drown my sorrows, and I was sat in the pub one day and chatting to some mates about these different businesses I'd set up and everything else. And one guy was like, you know what, you should go on that TV program, The Apprentice, where all failed entrepreneurs go. And I was like, oh yeah, I'd never heard of it. I didn't really watch much TV. We never did. So finished off my fifth pint, went up and filled out the application form a little bit jovially. And then wind forward 6 months, and I've been down for interviews, multiple interviews. I've been to Glasgow for interviews. I've been to London for interviews. Finally, I get the contract through to say I'm successfully going on the show, which is amazing. So, of course, I tell the whole island, which is, you know, 8.5 people and a dog. cheap. I tell them I'm going on The Apprentice, and go down, sat outside the studio for 4 hours with the producers coming in and out, in and out. You're going on. Oh, just hang on a minute. And then eventually they came out and said, look, we can't explain it, but you're not going on the show this time. And I was like, what? I mean, that's TV, isn't it? Just so anyway, okay. Well, thanks a bunch. And they said, we'll fly you back to Scotland. And I got to the, I think it was Heathrow Airport, I can't remember. And I was standing there, look at the departure board. And I thought, why am I going back to Scotland with my tail between my legs? And I looked at the departure board and the next flight was leaving to Ibiza. I thought, I'll take that. So went out to Ibiza and went absolutely bonkers, crazy for a few days. And then heard that there were some friends coming out. So I went to catch up with them, and that's where I bumped into an oil broker. And I got chatting to him about this, you know, all these different businesses and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, well, you should come and be an oil broker. So yeah, he kind of convinced me to enter the world of oil broking. And I moved down to London kind of on a whim and started that career. And it was an amazing career. You know, for me, it fit like a glove. Two parts of me, partying and being successful. And the more I partied, the more successful I was. Had a nice big budget to take people out. And, you know, I arrived on this desk where the guys were pretty senior. And they were like, look, none of us can be bothered to take the young ones out anymore. We need somebody on the desk who's gonna really take people out. So, yeah, I just used to put on the most crazy parties in nightclubs and organize events at restaurants and go to launch parties. And, yeah, it was fantastic. And I did that for 13 years. Was very successful, built up a successful oil broking desk. Met my wife, started to have a family. All of those wonderful things. And yeah, this drinking often started to cause some issues. And it wasn't that I was drinking every day. I could easily go for a week or two without having a drink, no problem. But it was part of my job. So boozy lunches might finish at 5 o'clock in the morning.
So I might think they would only have a problem with alcohol if they are quote unquote an alcoholic, where they are craving a vodka at 10 a.m. or a wine at lunch. They might think that, oh, I did the exact same that Rory did when he was on the oil desk. I don't have a problem with alcohol. What are some of the liminal or some of the ephemeral effects of this casual drinking culture, especially in the kind of culture that we see that surrounds finance and oil and corporate life, especially in the bigger cities like London? What are some of the symptoms that some might face?
Great question. First on, some terminology. So according to the scientific community, we've moved on now from words like alcoholic and alcoholism. So those words are actually reflective of the disease model. And we're not a proponent of the disease model. There is no disease of alcoholism. So what we talk about now in the scientific community is alcohol use disorder, AUD. And so what you would say is that person have significant alcohol use disorder, as an example. And then next, here's the other interesting thing. You talked about what are the symptoms. I think the thing is, a lot of people say, well, I don't have a problem with alcohol, so it's not a problem. Okay, that's great. Your definition of what a problem with alcohol may be the guy who's sat in the corner drinking out of his, you know, paper bag, homeless. And that's the guy with a problem with alcohol. I don't have that, so am I okay? Or you might say, well, I can stop for a month, so I don't have a problem with alcohol. So I think rather than saying, do you have a problem with alcohol? I think ask the question is alcohol causing me problems? Okay. And if we go with that conversation of is alcohol causing me problems, then I would say from all of the things, you struggle with sleep? Is sleep an issue? What about weight? Do you have a little bit too much weight on? Would you like to lose weight? What about focus, energy, clarity? Are you anxious, depressed? Do you feel sad sometimes? Overly emotional? Do you struggle to regulate your emotions? Have you wondered if you're ADHD? Are you having problems in your marriage? Do you have lack of confidence, lack of self-worth? Are you struggling to be as productive as you thought you were? Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have high cholesterol? Do you have high... do you have heart disease or early onset of heart disease? I reckon I could keep going now for hours, right? On the downstream effects of regularly consuming alcohol. And so if the downstream effects are so wide, then, and by the way, they are for things like sleep deprivation. So sleep deprivation on its own, I mean, you sleep deprive somebody for 5 days and they'll pass an ADHD test with flying colors. You sleep deprive somebody for 5 days and they may even show up as type 2 diabetes. So, I mean, all sorts of downstream effects of sleep deprivation, just as sleep deprivation is one thing, plus consuming alcohol causes sleep deprivation. Alcohol stops us from having good sleep. We think we're knocked out, but we're not actually getting that deep restorative sleep. What I think it's important to say to people is, hey, are there some issues or niggling things in your life that you've been trying to get on top of? Then why not just put this on the list of one of the first things to give a shot just to see if it makes any difference? You know, because if you decide to take a break or reduce how much you're drinking, and it impacts the thing that you've got niggling, whether it's high blood pressure or it's, I don't know, early start of an autoimmune disease, all sorts of things like that, then why not knock alcohol on the head first see if that starts to make a difference? Of course, when you work with somebody like us, it's not just about knocking alcohol on the head. In fact, it's way beyond that. In fact, I'm almost, I think that's like great to test it, wonderful thing to do. 9 times out of 10, it doesn't actually change your relationship with it. And people end up going back the way they are. If you actually want to fundamentally change your relationship with alcohol, then you have to go through a process of changing the underlying drivers. And the underlying drivers will be very varied on who you are, but you also have to cultivate out bad habits. You can't just rip them out because they always grow. They usually grow back and they usually grow back worse. So we cultivate them out by introducing good habits. And that's like looking at all those different things. I want alcohol because I'm trying to unwind after a busy day. Okay, well, then we need to talk about stress resilience. Then we need to talk about your central nervous system and trying to find calm during the day. Then we need to introduce good habits so that you get into parasympathetic during the day. Excuse me. And we use various devices and technology to help people see their central nervous system in data. And we also track them all the way through that journey to help them regulate themselves more so that it doesn't drive that busy brain at the end of the day where they need a drink. So yeah, there's a process to fundamentally change your relationship with alcohol, but whatever, take a break from it. It's whatever you try and do, any positive step forward trying to change your relationship with alcohol is a good one.
Fantastic, Rory. One of the things that I loved most from your work is hearing that our relationship with alcohol is often linked with our childhood experiences.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, let's take a few steps back. So first of all, if you look at late, I mean, ultimately, the reliance on alcohol. So I'm not just talking about going out to have a drink to be sociable. I'm talking about where you've started to rely on alcohol. So you need alcohol. You feel like you need it to have a good time. You feel like you need it to unwind a day. You feel like you need it to take the edge off or to relax, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Underneath this, compulsion, this regular compulsion. So we really talk about compulsive behavior. We don't talk about addiction because most of the room switches off. They say, well, I'm not an addict. That's not relevant to me. So we just talk about compulsion. Where there is compulsion, so that desire to take the edge off, and by the way, that could be cake, it could be Netflix, it could be social media. We all have it. I have compulsion, okay? Is that it is rooted, the vast majority is of its source comes from our past experiences as a child. Okay, well, that doesn't really make sense, Ruri. So why is my childhood making me want to have a drink? Back when you're 0 to 7, and it's predominantly that, during 0 to 7, we have not yet switched on our prefrontal cortex, which is the area of the brain just behind the forehead. We use that for rational decision-making. We use it for understanding the world around us, making sense of things, all sorts of things like that. That area of the brain is not yet switched on. So when some events happen to you, which could be being shut in your room, right, or alone, it could be being spanked, it could be being denied love, it could be having a narcissistic parent, it could be a violent parent, it could be a drunk parent, it could be any amount of abuse or whatever it is. Or maybe it wasn't even abuse, maybe it was just a lack of love, right? That during those times as a child, we can't rationalize those things. We don't understand it. So we feel some very intense emotion. And then what we're taught to do as human beings is pack that down. We're never taught how to deal with our emotions. Pack it down, be strong, there, come on, let's go. And then that continues on, right? And then we meet alcohol, and alcohol is one of the world's most powerful tools at packing down emotions. It's great at forgetting. I mean, it's instant forget, right? You're thinking about all the shit you've got to do for work, and you go and have one drink, and all of that crap has gone. It's amazing. So this is what we're doing, is continuing that packing down of emotions. But I think what we're just starting to understand from science today is just how toxic those emotions are. Those emotions are highly toxic, and they not only form compulsive behavior, but they also form autoimmune diseases and disorders, Alzheimer's, dementia, cancers, all sorts of things like that. So a lot of our compulsive behavior is rooted in there. There are also lots of other factors, right? So we run things on patterns. Maybe I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of mine. So although I had a fairly troublesome childhood, let's say, it wasn't really traumatic. I wasn't beaten. I wasn't sexually abused that I am conscious of or know of. There's nothing like that, right? I didn't fit in. There was bullying. I had a big family. There was et cetera. I've done a lot of work on this trauma stuff. I've done hundreds, maybe thousands of hours of talk therapy. I was in counseling when I was 6 years old. In almost every decade of life, I've done intensive counseling with psychoanalysts, CBT, psychodynamic therapists, psychologists, you name it. And it wasn't until much later when I started working with some of the tools that we use on our program, Complete Control, which is somatic experiencing and meditation, that I started to get towards a feeling. That feeling released in me that a sort of part of a memory, which then I brought to my parents, my mum, and she was like, oh yeah, well, when you were 2 years old, there was this incident when you fell off the boat. And this wasn't really talked about. It wasn't really discussed. It wasn't something that it was just, I don't know, a forgotten memory. And I found it through feeling from emotion. When I fell off the boat, my dad was down in the boat and he had to rush up and literally had to dive down and save me. It was a very, very traumatic experience. But what I put together from finding this feeling was that I had this pattern. I needed somebody to save me. And how that showed up in my life is I would create near-death experiences all the time, but I would always just have somebody there to save me, to pull me back from the edge. When I went to jump off George IV Bridge, a police car pulled up just at that moment to stop me and then drove me home. When I built my businesses later, they were always in suffering. And I was always looking for either an expert or a guru or an employee or some kind of superstar member of the team to come and save the business. And I didn't realize that pattern was running around in my head. I had no idea. Now, this is the power of past experience put into your ego that you then are running in pattern. as a wonderful, as a really interesting piece of body of work again, which is saying that because we form it into our ego as a child, our child has that belief, right? We have that belief in our head. I need somebody to save me, which is my pattern in my head. And so I'm now going to operate that I create more scenarios like that to prove that hypothesis true. So if you have a feeling of I'm not worthy, I'll never be good enough, I can't trust men, I can't trust women, I'm not safe on my own, right? I'm a loser, whatever that thing is. If that thing is stuck inside your brain, your subconscious is creating scenarios to prove yourself true. A scenario where, let's say you enter into a race that actually you could never win because you didn't put enough work in to do it, right? You didn't actually put the work in to do it. Purely so your subconscious can turn around and go, see, you didn't win it. You're not good enough. I told you, you're not good enough. And you go, you're right. You proved it to me again. I'm not good enough. And we all have these patterns and they're running around in our head. So that's a very long-winded answer. And there's so much more complexity to this. But in its essence, when people say, well, I don't want to go and sit in talk therapy for hours and hours now, I don't want to root around in the past, I've shut that, I've left that back there. And I'm like, great. And this is part of the reason why you're drinking, because those feelings are stuffed away and being ignored, and they just need to be felt. Now, the amazing thing with somatic experiencing is I don't need to sit for hours talking about your childhood. I don't need to. What we need to do is talk about what the feeling is. What shape is it? What size is it? Where is it in your body? How is it feeling? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it moving? Where is it now? And as you go through that experience, you start to release that emotion. And this is a game changer for people. I've had a guy who's second or third in command at one of the world's largest pharmaceuticals say to me, like, this has changed who I am. It's changed who I am as a person. I'm just never going to be the same again, because now I've seen all of these ways I'm operating based on those negative past emotions that I can put down. The one other thing I want to add on to that, I'm sorry, is once you become aware of it, so for me, I'm not going to become aware of a two-year-old memory. Most of us are not going to be consciously aware of what these feelings are. They're not of the conscious, they're of the subconscious, right? And so that's why traditional talk therapy can be difficult, because you're asking somebody to talk about something they're not consciously aware of. But once you have got aware of the pattern, so me, I need somebody to save me, I can just say something different. No, hang on a minute. Oh my God, I'm running that pattern again. I'm looking for somebody to save me. Fucking hell, Murray. I don't need anybody to save me. I've got this. I know what to do. Now that you can literally trace that in the P&L of my business. You can see the moment I made that realization, because that's when everything changed. And that's the power of releasing those things of the past.
That is super insightful, absolutely fascinating and revolutionary, Rory. I'm going to play devil's advocate, and this is, of course, not my belief, but someone might say, that sounds like a lot of work. That sounds like a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of emotional turmoil that I have to wade myself through. But these marketing campaigns and adverts are really enticing. If I have a beer, I'll be de-stressed. That's much easier. That's only £3 and a pop to the pub. If someone were to be of that rationale, what would you say to them?
So yes, well, that is it can sound like an awful lot of work. And here's the thing, is what we're doing now is saying, I just want to keep running away from it. I'm going to keep running away from it. And if you keep running away from it, you're going to get sicker and sicker and sicker. And it will be physical health, mental health, or just fucking shit up in your life. And it doesn't just come out in this. It comes out in bad relationships or shitty neighbors next door or problems at work or all sorts of stuff like that, which is what we're creating. And I think that instead of looking at this as, You're telling me right now I am at the bottom of Everest. I'm at the bottom. I haven't even started doing the work on this. Oh, my God. You're talking about my childhood? Oh, God. Oh, my God. I don't even want to go there. I'm right at the bottom of Everest. And where I want to be is at the top of Everest. Because let me ask you this question. Do you want to be happier? Do you want to be healthier? Do you want to be fitter? Do you want to have better relationships? Would you like to have a better relationship with your kids? Would you like to have a better relationship with your grandkids? Would you like to live longer? Would you like to improve your business? Double it this year, right? Would you like to have more productivity, more clarity, more energy, right? Would you like to finally have the body that you want? Would you like to look and feel how you do or have the expendable cash that you want? Well, all of those things come as a result of you doing the work, right? It's all about doing the work on ourselves and improving ourselves first. And the thing about the journey up, going up Everest is that instead of thinking about, oh my God, I've got 10 million steps to do, what happens is everything changes the moment that you just change the needle into that direction. It's not about being at the top. It's about going in that direction. Because once you start going in that direction, things start getting better. Every day they start getting better. Once you start training at the gym and you just keep going and you keep going, you get fitter and you get fitter and you get fitter. And then it gets easier and easier and easier. And then you like it more and you like it more and you like it more, right? The personal development journey, all it is about just showing up. And then you know that you're going to get to that fitness place. So I think this is exactly the same thing. Changing the needle into the direction, changing the compass into that direction, which is really what we help people do. We help people fundamentally shift that compass. When that happens, and you now have a clearer vision of who you want to be, the impact that you want to have in the world, the truth of where you're trying to go, is that every single day you're taking a step forward in that direction. Every single day you're getting better and better and better and stronger and stronger and stronger. And then I think that becomes the new addiction.
and over the last few weeks and if not months, I've been more open on the podcast, sharing my own personal experience with a listener. And like, I'm in my mid-20s, I'm 25, and I'd be lying if I said I haven't drank for the last 5 years on and off quite profusely. Never had a poor relationship with alcohol, but I've always had a relationship with alcohol. And over the last few months, as the podcast has began to grow and I've had my dream guest and I've had a more outlined direction of where I want this podcast to go and now tangible steps that I can see in front of me to get there, I have no excuse to drink. Drinking is a distraction from that goal. It's so much easier for me to bypass the Thursday night at the pub to go home and edit a podcast because I know the direction I'm traveling in now. But maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I didn't have that. And I truly believe I had a gent on the podcast called Tim Stoddard. Have you came across him before? Yeah. And he taught me that one of his phrases is, or he might have stole it from somewhere else, but he taught me that the opposite of addiction is connectivity.
Connection. And that's a famous TED talk by Johan Hari. It's called Everything We Know About Addiction Is Wrong. And Johan Hari coined that phrase. The opposite of addiction is connection.
I love that. And I really believe connection can be to this new direction or purpose. It doesn't have to be a community or a group of people.
Yeah. Connection in this part here is enabling happy, healthy, connected humans. And I think that there's an awful lot of stuff right now that is creating disconnection. And the reality is, you know, what we're saying is there's a lot of studies out there that say that drinking alcohol is good for you. And that is absolutely no. I mean, there's no study. I mean, all of the new science is showing us that no amount of alcohol is good for you, full stop. Okay. But what we are knowing is that being sociable and being around other people is really good for you. The issue is the only way to be sociable on the west coast of Scotland and many other areas is in the frickin' pub. There isn't anything else. So, and this is the change in society that we need to show is how do we foster intense connections with people, with a group of like-minded people around us who are living how we want to live, which is drinking less alcohol and alcohol not being the central focus of everything. There's this great behavior change study. And what they do is they take a school with a teacher up on the blackboard is a question, and they've got maybe 30 kids in there. Now, of these 30 kids, 29 are actors. One is not an actor. On the blackboard, it says, which one of these lines is longer? Now, it's very obviously D. D is hugely long. A, B, and C are all sort of medium-sized. A is very short. And it starts going around the room. And the first child goes, well, I think it's A, the wrong one. B, I think it's B. I think it's A. So they go through all 29 actors, all saying the wrong one. When it gets to the child who's not an actor, every single time, 100% of the time, that child will go for the wrong one. I think it's A. Under the peer pressure, under the system, under the way humanity works, we will follow the right path. If you think about the amount of peer pressure around alcohol and everything else out there in society, it's really hard to choose not to drink, to be the outlier. So, but what happens if you put in an expression of doubt? And what does that mean? So out of those 29 who say the wrong answer, one of them says, I think it could be D, the correct answer, but I'm going to go for A. So they're an expression of doubt. Every single time, the non-actor will go for the correct answer. I think it's D. So when we have that expression of doubt around us, when we have, if our entire community of people drink like fish all the time, we only need one or two. We only need a small handful. We only need an online community or something to belong to that will enable us to stay, say, in that moment when everyone's going, come on, just have one. And your subconscious mind is triggered in that moment. You go, no, thanks. I don't want one. Because you have that connection outside. So I think that's really important. And then when you look at all of this, you know, actually, as you go through changing your relationship with alcohol and drinking less, you realize there is more to life. You realize that the sunrises are incredible. You realize that a lot of people are drinking just out of boredom. And you're like, well, hang on a minute. I've only got one life. Why is there any moment of allowed for boredom? Why would I have boredom in there? And then we ask the question of, what is it about boredom that is so difficult for you? Because lots and lots of people don't like boredom because then they have to sit with themselves. And that's feeling those old emotions again. So they get bored, they feel loneliness, and they immediately want to have a drink. So those are all the things we need to unwind.
Rudy, what I love about you and your message is that one must not become completely sober to revolutionize their life. They just have to have a better relationship and improve their relationship with alcohol. Why don't you preach complete sobriety for a lifetime?
So I started, when I first started, I took a break from alcohol and it was the best thing ever. And then I got to a year and I decided to have a drink. It wasn't one, it was lots. And that's when I realized that abstinence does not equal control. I'd done a whole year and here I was still drinking like I used to, like power drinking. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. And then I did another year not drinking. And again, this time I went to have a few and it was just a drinking a lot less. And now I drink as much as I want, whenever I want. I just usually choose not to drink. So I then launched One Year No Beer. We've helped hundreds of thousands of people all over the world take a break from alcohol. And I saw the same things again and again, is that people were taking a break but going back to problematic drinking very quickly. Meanwhile, we've been doing a lot of user interviews and speaking to people, and they would say, you know, it took me 2 years to sign up to your program. And I was like, why? They said, well, because I don't really want to stop drinking. And then we put out a piece of research and we asked now over 40,000 people, what would you like your relationship with alcohol to look like? 6% want to stop drinking. The rest would like a better relationship with alcohol. So all of that brought me along to the place that, well, hang on a minute. If it took somebody 2 years to submit to taking a break from alcohol, like, I really don't want to, but I have to, then why aren't we talking about control? Why aren't we talking about reducing drinking? Why aren't we just saying, hey, buddy, why don't we just drink a little bit less tonight? Oh, yeah, I'll sign up for that. I'll sign up for drinking a little bit less tonight. Now, then we get you in and we say, look, let's try doing that thing of reducing drinking. If it works, fantastic. But if it doesn't, then you probably need to take a break. And the getting control, the fastest way to get control is to take a break. Do you want this to take 2 years? Or would you rather get control in, I don't know, in the next few months? I'd rather do it in the next few months. Great. Well, you'll get there much quicker if you take a break from it. It's very hard to reduce your drinking whilst in that cycle of drinking. Very hard. And for many people, impossible for them to find a place of moderation. And that's why then our immediate answer would be, hey, you need to stop. and stopping is the best way for you then to even see if it's possible for you to get control. Because again, for some people, it may not be possible for them. I actually believe it's possible for anyone as long as they change the things that are driving it, of which we now know. We know what's driving that behavior. So, cut a very long story short, we can help people a lot earlier in the journey of their relationship with alcohol if we talk about control and we talk about reducing. I'm talking about years, maybe even a decade earlier, right? A decade earlier of getting support, of steering away from a more problematic relationship with alcohol. So let's really focus in on that with people, like, hey, let's try to drink less. The second thing is that, and this is what people are looking for. They're looking to try and reduce their drinking. They're looking to try and get better control of it. They're waking up on Sunday morning going, gosh, I wish I didn't drink so much every time, things like that. I think, yeah, we can help people a lot sooner, avert more problems. And I'm a preventative health company, and I think that prevention should always swim upstream. So it's about trying to find earlier and earlier and early ways for people preventing more serious harm later on.
Rory, I absolutely love this message. In a world, or in a digital world, where sobriety is so binary, either you drink or you don't, and you're lambasted if you're in that middle ground, I love that your narrative is that you can have a better relationship. And I'm so glad that you're swimming your narrative upstream. Especially when the stats are 90%+ still want to have a relationship with alcohol, just a better one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look at society. I mean, that's the truth. I recorded a video today. Drinking is fun. I'm not going to be the guy who decides to stop drinking and then go on all over social media saying drinking alcohol is boring. No, it fucking isn't. It's great fun. I mean, have a few drinks with friends, lose all inhibitions, forget about the world, end up dancing on a table. I would normally turn into a complete idiot after 5 pints, outrageous idiot after 10, but it'd still be great laughs. But it isn't the next day. And it definitely isn't the day after that and the day after that. Usually, sometimes it can be 5 days, sometimes it can be longer, and it's a shit price to pay. And I don't want to pay that price anymore. I just don't want to pay that price of the impact that it has on my life. So saying all of that is as well, not just helping people earlier, but it was also recognizing that there was this big movement about sobriety, which again, very driven by the traditional 12-step AA world, where it's like, oh, you can't, and you can never drink again, and you have a disease, and you're going to have it for the rest of your life, and you must submit yourself to God, and this is the way it's going to be forever. What? That was unhelpful to a huge amount of people as well, because they're like, well, that's not me. So I'll just carry on. And there's no support for somebody like me. And now we've got that mixture of world. And I get a lot of hate out there for even suggesting that somebody might be able to control their drinking. And A, why would you ever say to anyone that drinking is fun, like they've completely forgotten and it didn't exist why they drank in the first place? And two, how can you tell somebody they can control their drinking? It's a lie. It's impossible and everything else. And I'm like, look, do you know that the most successful intervention in the world for somebody with alcohol use disorder, the most successful by far of percentage of people in the world who have been healed from alcohol use disorder exists. It ain't my program. I wish it was. It's time. A perfectly natural thing that means that people grow out of alcohol use disorder. So there's many ways to skin the cat. And I'm just focused on that. I think we can help people earlier and we can help many, many more people if we focus on giving people the right tools to be able to control their drinking. If you get somebody in your hands who has a very, very serious relationship with alcohol, their core drivers are significant. So very significant trauma, very broken relationships, a huge amount of stress, mental health illness, absolute emotion, no emotional regulation. I could keep going through all the list. If those chips are really, really down, then yeah, it's going to be almost impossible for them to control their drinking. And therefore, they should just focus on abstinence. It's much easier. And then their life is not falling apart and they're not running a risk of that. And I think if we can help people see that as the truth, The idea of our complete control program is really to take people through this journey of 8 weeks using technology, data, and evidence, showing them with clarity, this is the reason why you drink. These are the things that are driving it. And when you change these things, you will drink less alcohol. It's that simple. And so that's the whole point of that program, to give people that exact understanding. And I will say that we are here for, you know, we're in this prevention world. I'm here for high-performing executives, business owners, people who are, you know, it's not, and people who don't feel like they are severely addicted, but they do feel like they're out of control sometimes. They feel like they're relying on alcohol a bit too much, either at the end of the day, most days having a drink to take the edge off, or when they binge drink, it never stops at one and the wheels come off and they cause all sorts of problems in their life. We help them that. One perfect example, and this guy, I'm going over to the US to shoot with him. He's an ex-pro NFL athlete. I mean, megastar athlete. Not one of the top, I mean, not in the top two, but in the top 10. And he then left NFL, built a large private equity business, hugely successful, 12 times Ironman champion. The guy is a freaking machine. And he says to me, Ruri, I can stop drinking for a year, no problem. That's not my issue. But when I do have a drink, it's like I've won the Super Bowl and I'm gone for 3 days. And he said, if you can fix that, then, I mean, wow. And I said, come on then, let's give it a shot. So he came through the program. Obviously, we found typical stuff, right? I mean, anyone that very, very, very driven like that, they're probably going to have childhood stuff. it drives work addiction as well. And so he comes through the program. 3 months after the program, after he completes it, he sends me this wonderful text message saying, you know, I went with my brothers, usually a massive trigger for him. It would be very problematic. I went with my brothers to a boutique hotel. I only drank on one evening. I finished it. I cut it off by midnight. I didn't drink the rest of the time. Learning control was so much easier than stopping drinking. You know, I'm now in full control. Then on the Super Bowl, he was in Vegas. And normally that would be 5 days of absolute mayhem for him. On the Saturday night, he sends me a WhatsApp with a picture of him having an Guinness Zero and eating some kind of salad with, what the fuck have you done to me? With 5 questions. So, and we're going out to do a sort of documentary with him. We're going to start working with the NFL, helping ex-pro NFL athletes, which is just rife with addiction. He's like, your program is almost unbelievable that you have been able to get me where I am, because there is nothing out there that says that's possible. In fact, there's a huge body of people that would say what you have done to me is impossible. So yeah.
Unbelievable. That is absolutely unbelievable. I'm really glad that that use case and case study really brings to life like the impact of your program, given the fact that from the outside in, someone would look at an NFL all-star and think he must have control. I mean, his diet must be in place, his training must be in place, he must be up early to train, but he even struggled to control that one aspect of his life. It just shows you the necessity for an intervention and a preventative measure.
This is one of the most common things that we deal with, mostly business owners in the high level program that we do with people. It's very driven business owners. I've had billionaires on the program, celebrities. I've had, you know, ex-pro athletes. I've had NFL, NHL, rugby, BBC, whatever they're called. Yeah. So we've had all top level people. Here's the thing. The drive for success for many, 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 many people is rooted in the same stuff. And the drive for success, which compounds your central nervous system, means that there's so much stress on your central nervous system that it comes out in compulsive behavior. So, and the compulsive behavior could be porn, gambling, sugar, alcohol, whatever it is. So we help people to really regulate themselves better over that. And this is why it's so, so, so common. And what you just said there is what most of them say. I am in control of every area of my life except this one. And if you can help me get on top of that, then I'll be in a great place. So, yeah.
Ruri, what's the intersection between ADHD and AUD?
Nice one. So, well, Only that ADHD, the percentage of people who end up with substance misuse and in general drugs and alcohol who have ADHD is very, very high. I mean, you're five times more likely to have a substance use disorder if you are ADHD or neurodivergent in general. This whole ADHD hyperactivity really drives that central nervous system. So it's a lot of stress on your central nervous system all the time. And we're not taught how to regulate. We're also not, emotional regulation is very difficult for many ADHDers. There's a body of evidence out there showing that actually ADHD is a coping mechanism for a traumatized child. And what we've started on here is saying that alcohol or compulsive behavior is driven by trauma. So these things are totally intrinsically linked. I'm ADHD. Sometimes I need to just go and blow up my world. And now I'm older and sensibler. I do it in more careful ways that don't mean the absolute end of my life. But back when I was younger, it was way, way, way more aggressive. And I think, the tools and the strategies for holistically managing ADHD are the same or very, very similar that are for managing compulsive behavior. And in fact, the tools and the strategies that we're teaching people are the same things that are helping people reverse autoimmune disease. Yes, I've had a lady who was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. She decided to come and take on our program because, it kind of ticked a lot of the boxes of what the doctor says, you need to stop drinking, you need to do this. 3 months after the program, she sends us literally a picture of her diagnosis showing that she's completely in remission after coming through the program. No signs of an autoimmune disease. So a lot of this stuff is connected. And I think, unfortunately, we live in a world where it profits immeasurably off your ill health by giving you pills, especially in the US. And what we should be doing is starting with the basics with people. That's just, Gabor Mate says it perfectly, right? When will the doctor sit you down and say, right, tell me what happened to you before you go into detail about anything else? And then, what happened in the past? How is your stress? What is your sleep like? Are you exercising? Are you meditating? Are you calming your central nervous system? Are you finding calm during the day? How often is your parasympathetic nervous system activated? What's your diet like? This is where we should be starting.
My previous guest, Dr. Meg Jay, who's a clinical psychologist that focuses on 20-something-year-olds, says that we should be prescribing skills, not pills, and you brought that to life exactly.
I love it. Skills, not pills.
Rory, if the listener, whoever that may be, regardless of age, gender, career, title, location, if they're thinking, I would like to control my relationship with alcohol, I want to take the first next step. What would you say to them?
Just follow me on Instagram.
And what's your handle?
R Fairbairns or OYMB, 1 year no beer. Produce tons of content, loads of support, always there. If you need to reach out, hit me in the DMs. That can be your step one. And once you take that step there, I'm going to start to educate you and make you think differently about your relationship with alcohol. I'm going to hopefully inspire you. And then you'll just start naturally taking the progress together. If you've already been on this journey for a little bit and you want to get a hold of it, you want to do something more serious, I'd highly recommend Complete Control. It's an incredible program. We use technology, data, and evidence to take people through a journey and see with clarity what is driving it and then coach them through a process of changing that. Step one, just nice and easy. Follow me on Instagram. And if you don't even want to do that, your step one can be, if you're thinking about changing your relationship with alcohol, I think go in search of four things. Don't go in search of just sobriety on its own. It's a great thing. It's a great tool, but it's not the answer. Really, we need accountability. We need connection. We need education. And we need support. And they can come in very, very different factors. But the more you have of those four things, the more likely you are to be successful. Accountability, connection, education, and support.
I love it, Ru. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And there we go, another episode of the Development by David podcast. I hope that episode made you a little bit more aware of the casual alcohol consumption that you might be having, or it may empower you to take the next step towards a more alcohol-conscious lifestyle. I really like Rory and his style of communicating that message. Most people in the sobriety space that I know are very preachy, but he's very advisory. If you enjoyed this episode, please, please, please give it a share and join my Patreon, where you can get episodes just like this early, and you can get access to my stand-up comedy specials and even my episode with Jimmy Carr a week in advance. Head along to patreon.com/developmentbydavid. For the price of a coffee, you can support this podcast. See you in the next one.